Hey, Mike here. I just wanted to let you know that you can listen to Dark Poutine early and ad-free on Amazon Music, included with Prime. Welcome back to Dark Poutine. And I am Michael Brown in Langley, British Columbia.
And I am Matthew Stockton in Vancouver, not in Abbotsford like Mike.
I'm not in Abbotsford. You'll get it right one of these days. I might, you know, who knows? I might end up living in Abbotsford and then you will be right. So
I'm thinking about going to Abbotsford to watch some rugby soon.
Really? Is there rugby sevens in Abbotsford?
No, I decided why only do once a year rugby sevens when there's an entire BC
rugby league.
Leagues, and go watch them.
There you go.
And I can take Steve because it's not in a stadium.
So it's outdoors.
Yeah.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah, you can take Steve and then he can bark at the men with their bums running around.
He doesn't bark at people.
Oh, that's good. Anyway, let's do this thing.
Okay.
The views, information, and opinions expressed during the Dark Poutine podcast are solely those of the producer and do not necessarily represent those of Curious Cast, its affiliate, Global News, nor their parent company, Chorus Entertainment.
Dark Poutine is not for the faint of heart or squeamish. Listener discretion is strongly advised. We're not experts on the topics we present, nor are we journalists. We're two ordinary Canadians chatting about crime and the dark side of history. Let's get to it. Put on your toque, grab yourself a double-double and a Nanaimo bar. It's time to scarf down some Dark Poutine.
You are responsible for obtaining and maintaining at your own cost all equipment needed to listen to Dark Poutine. Dark Poutine can be addictive. Side effects may include, but not be limited to, pausing and questioning the system, elevated heart rate, pondering humanity, odd looks from colleagues as you laugh out loud at work, family members not into true crime worrying about you. Positive side effects may include some perspectives and opinions that you disagree with, as well as some wokeness and empathy. If you don't think Dark Poutine is for you, consult your doctor immediately.
In a home in Shediac, New Brunswick, on February 13, 1805, Amos Babcock, driven by delusions of divine mission, subjected his family to a horrifying ordeal. He gathered his wife, children, and sister Mercy, instilling fear with his erratic behavior and unsettling declarations. Spurred by imagined threats and seeing himself as an instrument of God, Amos prepared for a sacrificial act, treating his family with cruelty dressed up as a religious ritual. His deep descent into madness was evident as he inflicted violence upon his loved ones, sparing none of them from his erratic wrath. Babcock's final act of brutality saw him murder his sister Mercy Babcock Hall, whom he saw as demonic, in a brutal frenzy of madness, bringing a tragic end to a night of unspeakable horror. This is Dark Poutine, episode 312, Moved by the Spirit, The Murder of Mercy Babcock Hall. So Kelly McDonald Mason of Riverview, New Brunswick, suggested this story in our case suggestion thread in the Yumberyard, our Facebook group. And I knew of this historical case, but digging into the details has been fascinating, so thank you to Kelly for the suggestion.
Shout out to Kelly!
Big ups to Kelly. Shediac, the setting for this story, is located in the southeastern part of the Canadian province of New Brunswick, on the coast of the Northumberland Strait and 25 kilometers northeast of Moncton. It is renowned for its beautiful beaches and has been nicknamed the lobster capital of the world due to its significant lobster fishing industry. The town is situated near several major routes and waterways, making it an accessible and strategically positioned community. Shediac has a rich history, reflecting on the broader trends and transformations in what is now Canada. Before European settlement, the area around Shediac was inhabited by the Mi'kmaq indigenous people who called the place Esediac, which is thought to mean running far in, or describes the long tidal range at Shediac Bay. The Mi'kmaq used the area for fishing, hunting, and gathering.
You know, how places get their names, I always find fascinating, I guess.
I love that, too. Like, I'm from Bridgewater, and surprise, there's a bunch of bridges over the river there.
Absolutely. And all over the world, the early place names often referred to the natural landscape or what people did in the area. So, for example, Toronto is derived from the Iroquois term meaning where there are trees and water. Previously, we actually thought it was a Huron word for meeting place, but a new scholarly article said, well, actually it's Iroquois.
Oh, well, la-di-da.
Yeah, and of course, we now have names for things like streets like Mill Lane, where there'd be Mill, or Bridgewater, right?
Or Dildo, Newfoundland.
Yeah, exactly. Well, speaking of that, in the UK is fantastic for street and place names. So, for example, there's Booty Lane, which is, while funny, it doesn't mean like your bum. It's where bootmakers worked. And sure. Then, of course, there is Grope Lane.
Oh,
which was once called, I'm not going to say it out loud, it's once called Grope, See You Next Tuesday Lane, and it's where sex workers worked.
Oh boy, I heard the word grope and I thought immediately that a certain somebody would probably like to travel that lane.
Oh, don't go there.
I won't travel any further down that alley. The late 18th century saw an increase in European settlement in the Maritimes, including what would become New Brunswick. Like much of the region, Shediac initially attracted attention for its strategic location and natural resources. The area was part of Acadia, a region contested between the French and British empires during the 17th and 18th century. By the Treaty of Utrecht in 1713, the British gained control over Acadia, but the French and indigenous peoples remained influential there. The first European settlers in Shediac, New Brunswick, were predominantly Acadians and Pennsylvanian Dutch, arriving in the mid-18th century. This area is known for its strategic coastal location along the Northumberland Strait, quickly becoming a focal point for early settlement and trade. The Acadians, French colonists establishing communities throughout Maritime Canada since the 17th century, were attracted to Shediac for its fertile lands and abundant fishing opportunities. The Pennsylvanian Dutch, or Pennsylvania Germans, brought advanced farming techniques and a strong work ethic, contributing significantly to the area's agricultural development. Despite the challenges of frontier life and the turmoil of historical conflicts, such as the Acadian expulsion, these early settlers laid the foundation for Shediac's growth into a vibrant community. Their legacy is evident in the area's rich cultural heritage, which continues to celebrate both Acadian and Pennsylvania Dutch influences. During the 1790s into the 19th century, Shediac began to develop as a community. The end of the American Revolutionary War in 1783 led to the arrival of United Empire Loyalists, American colonists loyal to the British Crown who settled in Canada, including areas around New Brunswick. These settlers contributed to the population growth and infrastructure development in the region. Fishing and shipbuilding emerged as significant industries in Shediac and the surrounding areas. The rich Northumberland Strait fishing grounds provided many settlers a livelihood. Shipbuilding was facilitated by the abundant timber resources and Shediac's strategic maritime location, making it an essential center for these industries in the early 19th century. The early 1800s saw continued growth in Shediac and development to support its economic activities. Roads, wharves, and other facilities were built to facilitate trade and transportation. The community established itself as a vital link in the region's maritime economy. The family at the focus of this tragic tale, the Babcocks, headed by Patriarch Amos, came to New Brunswick from Nova Scotia. Amos's parents, Jonathan Babcock and Lydia Lee, united in marriage on November 26, 1749, in South Kingston, Rhode Island. They then embarked on a journey that would extend their family roots from the American colonies to the burgeoning settlements of Nova Scotia. The couple's lineage blossomed with the birth of 9 children, each making a poignant chapter in the Babcock family story. The eldest, Mercy, the victim in this tale, was born on October 14, 1750 in Exeter, Rhode Island, heralding the beginning of Jonathan and Lydia's expanding family. Tragically, the second child, Mary Babcock, born in October 1751, lived only for a month, passing away in November of that year in Exeter. This sorrow was further compounded by the loss of their son, John Babcock, born in 1753, who died in 1760, also in Exeter, underscoring the harsh realities faced by early American families. Amid these hardships, the family's resilience shone through in the births of Frederick Babcock in 1756 and Jonathan Babcock Jr. in 1757, both in Exeter. The decision to migrate northward to Newport, Nova Scotia, brought new beginnings and further additions to the family with the birth of another son, John Babcock, in 1760 or 61, reflecting the tradition of reusing names in the wake of earlier children's deaths. The family's adaptation to their new environment was marked by the births of Lydia Babcock in 1762, Amos Babcock, Mercy's killer, in 1764, and Gideon Babcock in 1765, who died in childhood, all in Newport, signifying the family's growing ties to their new homeland. The Babcocks, characterized by their industrious yet humble lifestyle, worked in farming and fishing. On December 7, 1772, Mercy married Abner Hall Jr. in a ceremony held at St. John's Anglican Church in Cornwallis Parish, Nova Scotia. Abner was born on July 4, 1749 in Connecticut, the son of Abner Hall Sr. and Mary Russ. This union connected two families deeply embedded in the fabric of early American and Canadian colonial life.
You know, I had some recent family, well, I guess it's not news, but somebody not related to us for the Strathroy Historical Society, the town I'm from, found an article about somebody named Hannah Stockton, who was actually my great-great-grandmother. So Valerie, who listens to this show and is an old neighbor of mine, actually saw that and sent me to it. And I found out something interesting. I am pretty early Canadian colonial family. So my family, I'm seventh generation from the town I was born in. Like not the country, but from the town, seventh generation. And the earliest sort of recording was one of the first children born to my family in 1840. So my family was in my hometown before 1840. I found that really fascinating.
Interesting. That's really interesting.
Also found out that I had some Irish Protestant blood in me as well.
Well, our family, the Brown family anyway, Brown with an E, came from Ireland as well. Interestingly, in the early census in Canada, well, I guess before it was really Canada, it was like the 1700s, Francis Brown, who was the initial guy to come over, didn't spell his name with an E, Brown with an E. So somewhere along the way, we got snooty. I don't know. Or maybe it was just like a mistake on the census part. I don't know. But somewhere along the way, no, it's with an E. It's Brown with an E.
Brown A.
Anyway, I find history fascinating. It's part of why I do this podcast. Keeping with the tradition of large families at the time, Mercy and Abner Hall Jr. welcomed 8 children into their family. The eldest, Samuel Hall, was born on March 6, 1774. Following Samuel, Lydia Hall entered the world on February 2, 1775. The Hall family continued to grow with the birth of James Hall on March 6, 1776, demonstrating a notable pattern of close birth years among the siblings. Mercy had a brief break from birthing babies until Nathan Hall was born on January 27, 1779, followed by John Hall on March 24, 1781. Elizabeth Hall was born on May 19, 1783, adding a daughter to the bustling family home. Mercy Hall, sharing her mother's name, was born on July 8, 1785, highlighting the tradition of naming children after their parents. The youngest of the siblings, William Hall, was born on July 26, 1787, rounding out the Hall family children. However, Mercy's life took a dramatic turn in her early 40s. Around the age of 41, after her last child was born, she fell severely ill, suffering from a high fever that tragically impacted her mental health. This illness caused her to become emotionally distressed, a condition that had profound effects on her personal life and family. As a result of her illness, described by some as profound melancholy, her husband decided to separate from her, taking their children with him. This separation marked a significant and painful chapter in Mercy's life, breaking her spirit and highlighting the challenges and limited understanding of mental health issues during that period. I mean, talk about add insult to injury. She's already has the blues in a big way, and here he is, I'm going to leave you and take the kids.
Yeah, I mean, profound melancholy actually kind of sounds romantic, those words. Mm-hmm. But it just shows that how there was such little understanding of the human brain back then.
Sure.
And probably, like, honestly, Mike, if there was that lack of understanding and somebody around mental health issues, it's not surprising that he would have left with the kids in a way, right? Because they didn't know how to treat anything and they didn't really know what it was, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so having mental illness back then would have been harder than it is today, yeah.
Well, it's a hellscape now. It would have been even worse.
Yeah, imagine then, yeah.
Not only do you not feel well, everybody else doesn't seem to care and thinks it's all your fault.
Or that you're like have demons or something, right?
You're out of your mind or have demons or yeah. During this tumultuous time, Mercy found solace and support with her brother Amos Babcock. In 1788, 24-year-old Amos married Dorcas Bennett, 20, originally from Horton, Nova Scotia, at the Congregational Church in Chipman's Corner. In 1791, along with his wife and their daughter, Dorcas Babcock, born a year earlier, and as tradition indicated, named for her mum, Amos moved his family to New Brunswick. In her depression, Mercy Babcock Hall chose to live with Amos, his wife, and their baby daughter, seeking refuge and a sense of family amidst her personal struggles. Some accounts indicate that Mercy's sister-in-law Dorcas did not like her very much, seeing her as weak-willed and a burden to her own growing family. That family continued expanding with the birth of Henry Babcock, their first son, who arrived in 1791, born in Hopewell, New Brunswick. Second son, Caleb H. Babcock, was born in 1793, also in Hopewell. The family tree continued to grow with Annie Babcock's birth in 1797 and Mercy Babcock, named for their aunt, was born in 1798. Delilah was born in 1800 and Sarah was born in 1801. Both of them were born in Hopewell. Elizabeth and Amy Babcock, the youngest, were born in 1803 and 1804 in Shediac and Shediac Bridge, respectively. Shediac, New Brunswick, was a developing settlement with few English families. Among them were Amos Babcock, his brother Jonathan, and William Hannington, a prominent figure who established his home after a challenging journey from Halifax. Hannington, committed to his faith, held Church of England services at his home, becoming a spiritual anchor for the community without Protestant churches. Hannington took Amos and his family under his wing and generously helped to support them financially. The community experienced a significant religious revival in 1804, marked by heightened enthusiasm and apocalyptic beliefs. This revival was fueled by the Baptist denomination's influence and the arrival of a preacher named Joseph Crandall. This event led to extraordinary religious fervor, transforming the spiritual life of the settlement, making it fertile ground for what would happen later. Religion played a pivotal role in shaping the early social and cultural fabric of New Brunswick, mirroring the province's diverse ethnic and linguistic landscapes in the early 1800s. The province's settlement and migration history profoundly influenced its religious practices and community structures. New Brunswick's demographic composition during this period included a significant mix of French Acadians, English, Irish, and Scots, each bringing their own religious traditions and establishing communities around these beliefs.
I find this interesting as well. When different religions move into an area, there's almost a competition that's created.
Mm-hmm.
And you often see sort of the competition take form in terms of who is the most pious or the most fervent, or
sure,
or what is the right way to do it. I was speaking to a designer that I work with just this week by chance, not knowing we were going to talk about this, and who grew up in the Catholic Church, and we're just laughing how he said, the priest told him that non-Catholics, unfortunately, go to hell, right?
Oh.
So it didn't even matter if other people are Christians. If they weren't Catholic, he was taught when he was young, if you're not Catholic, you're going to hell.
Oh,
right?
Boy.
And I don't know if that's said very often anymore in the Catholic Church or other churches. But, Canada today generally is less religion focused than the USA.
Yeah.
In the book Fire and Ice, Canada, the United States, and the Myth of Converging Values is the name of the book. They actually posit that in the States, where there was that strict separation of church and state, that they always spoke of, that separation almost created a vacuum from which where religious groups grew and competed, and that's why it became actually a more religious country. Mm-hmm. Well, in Canada, you had the French and the Irish. Some of the Irish were Catholic, right? And that was almost like a given if you were French, you're Catholic. And the rest of us had sort of the king of head of state and the head of church. And sure. And that sort of duality made it sort of religion a little bit more benign, and there was less competition. So we oddly, even though it wasn't a separation of church and state, we oddly became less religious because of it.
Well, this story doesn't speak to how benign religion is in Canada. So we'll get into some more interesting things.
Absolutely, but this was a very long time ago. I'm talking more contemporary time.
Sure,
over time, this happened, right?
Yeah. Okay. The forced expulsion of the Acadians, who were primarily Catholic, by the British in the mid-18th century drastically reduced the Catholic population, paving the way for Protestant dominance. The latter part of the 18th century saw an influx of Protestant settlers, especially United Empire Loyalists, fleeing the aftermath of the American Revolution, who were mainly of Anglican and other Protestant affiliations. The Loyalists, comprising mainly British, Dutch, German, and even African Americans, brought with them Protestant denominations, particularly the Anglican and Baptist traditions. This influx of Loyalists after the American Revolution notably increased the Protestant population in the southern parts of New Brunswick, establishing a distinct religious landscape that contrasted with the predominantly Catholic regions in the north and eastern parts of the province. The early 19th century saw further diversification with the arrival of Irish and Scottish immigrants, many fleeing famine and seeking new opportunities in Canada. These groups further enriched the province's religious tapestry, contributing to a predominantly Christian demographic that persisted into the modern era. Despite this diversity, communities often centered their social activities around their churches, which served as crucial gathering points for worship, education, and mutual support in the often challenging conditions of early settlement life. Eventually, Protestantism would hold a more prominent position than Catholicism. Protestantism remained the more widespread religious tradition despite some Catholic presence, especially as the Acadians began to move back, and later Irish immigrants who arrived toward the end of the 18th and early 19th centuries. This era was marked by British influence and immigration patterns from predominantly Protestant regions of the British Isles, which entrenched Protestantism's dominance in New Brunswick's religious and cultural identity in the early years of the 19th century. The indigenous populations of New Brunswick, including the Mi'kmaq and the Maliseet, were exposed to both Catholic and Protestant missionary efforts. The success of these missions varied, with some indigenous communities embracing Christianity while others fiercely maintained their traditional beliefs. Itinerant preachers saw the New World settlements as the perfect place to spread their version of the gospel to both settlers and indigenous populations. An itinerant preacher, fundamentally, is a minister who travels across different locations instead of leading a single stationary congregation. This approach is especially prevalent within evangelical and revivalist Christian traditions, where the goal is to spread religious messages and teachings far and wide. These preachers are known for their dynamic mobility, moving from one community to another, often focusing their efforts on rural or underserved areas where established churches might be rare. Itinerant preachers are adaptable, utilizing whatever spaces are available, private homes, school buildings, or even open fields to gather people for worship and spiritual instruction. Although this type of preaching did bring the good word to many who otherwise may not have heard it, the mobility and relative anonymity of the itinerant preacher's life also attracted some unsavory characters. Like snake oil salesmen of the day, they wanted to take as many vulnerable people in as they could, be it for money, sex, or some other form of power. One of these preachers was a man named Jacob Peck. He came to Shediac early in January 1805 to spread his fiery take on the gospel. There had been other preachers before him, but Peck impacted the tiny community and the Babcock family like none other before. More after a quick break. And we're halfway through this episode, Matthew. What are your thoughts so far?
So often I've seen programs, or even we've spoken about this, where mental health and religion and the idea of demons and all sort of merge back in the oldie days.
Yep.
And some people actually say in some religions, some of the visions that people saw, right?
Yeah.
Where like various churches or whatever.
Different sects are based on all these.
Yeah, are based on actual somebody being a schizophrenic, right? And but the church or the sect said, oh, you know, it was a divine vision.
Yeah, look at Joan of Arc, for example. She's a prime example of that.
Maybe she is. Maybe she actually saw the Virgin Mary.
Exactly. You don't know.
And well, we kind of do, but so it's just fascinating to see another story back then where these things are all sort of mixed up together.
The most detailed accounting of the life of preacher Jacob Peck comes from author Deborah Comar's book about this case, The Ballad of Jacob Peck. According to Comar, Jacob Peck's life started from his birth in 1765 in Cumberland County, Nova Scotia. It unfolds a tale of migration, struggle, and the quest for social standing in the nascent communities of Nova Scotia and New Brunswick. His story is deeply rooted in the Peck family's journey from Germany to the New World, driven by Martin Peck, originally Martin Beck, and his brother Michael's escape from religious persecution. Their transformation from Beck to Peck upon their arrival in Halifax symbolizes the broader theme of adaptation and change faced by immigrants. Martin's relocation to Fort Cumberland, where he met and married Maria Sophia Kuntz, led to a burgeoning family of 10 children amidst the hardships of subsistence farming. This era's harsh realities, coupled with Martin's endeavor to secure land through a crown land lottery, highlight the period's socioeconomic challenges and the profound impact of land ownership on settlers' fortunes. Emerging from this background, Jacob Peck inherited his father's belief in land as the pathway to prosperity. However, His early life and subsequent actions reveal a complex figure, marked by dubious character traits and a contentious relationship with his community. Though marked by a lack of distinction, Jacob's attempts at social advancement through various parish offices underline his deep-seated desire for recognition and status. His ventures into preaching, devoid of genuine religious fervor, further exemplify his manipulative tendencies and quest for social ascendance. Despite a Protestant upbringing, Peck's engagement with the New Light movement suggests a pragmatic adoption of religious platforms for personal gain rather than spiritual enlightenment. His interactions with women, as noted in the 1803 census, add another layer to his contentious character, pointing toward exploitative tendencies. Jacob Peck's personal life reveals a complex character, marked by transient relationships and social ambitions. He was much less godly than he expected his parishioners to be. In 1803, he had lived with a woman and two children in Salisbury, whose relationship with him was ambiguous, indicating his disregard for conventional family structures. His engagement to Joyce Allrod in 1804, who was from a different area and not the woman he lived with, brought forth some interesting information. Their marriage certificate, taken out in December before Peck left for Shediac and his fateful meetings with the Babcock family, was signed with an X. The preacher was an illiterate grifter. He'd never read the Bible from which he preached.
You know, I find people like Peck, and they're a dime a dozen these days as well, so loathsome, because, you know, I'm not religious at all, and I'll poke fun of at religion, but I don't poke fun of spirituality and teachings and people trying to figure out that inner journey on how to be good or how to be better or how to deal with this world that we live in, right? And get some consolation out of it.
Right.
And people like Peck, who bastardize, because if you look back to most religions, they meant for something to be good at the beginning and about an inner journey. And then you have people like Peck who, for power or politics or control or money, you know, totally use religion the wrong way. And that's the word I'm looking for.
Yeah, they co-opt their faith for their own weird gains.
Yeah.
Be it their ego or money or sex or something else.
And there's almost nothing worse in my mind, right? Because because people who are looking at spiritual teachings are generally trying to, sometimes misguided, but trying to be better.
You know? It is a horrible type of predator who will do that.
Yeah.
Jacob Peck's relationships with women and his manipulative engagements, including another after Mercy's murder, combined with the revelation of his illiteracy, paint a picture of a man deeply concerned with his social standing, willing to enter into and break personal bonds to achieve it, and adept at concealing his true capabilities and intentions from the community around him. When Peck came to Shediac, he began evangelizing. Not everyone liked what he had to say. Those who mistrusted Peck included Amos Babcock's benefactor, William Hannington, and brother, Jonathan Babcock. After hard-won wisdom, having been taken in more than once himself, Hannington knew a huckster when he saw one. Peck quickly inserted himself into the community's religious life, offering to lead services and winning over several local leaders with his charismatic but unsettling approach. His day-long sermon in Amos Babcock's home, attended by many, including Hannington and his wife, was notably dramatic. He declared himself John the Baptist and prophesied the end of days, demanding total belief and submission from his audience. The event was marked by bizarre phenomena and Peck's manipulative dominance, particularly over Amos Babcock, who he praised excessively, pushing Babcock into a prominent role. The revival, filled with zealous expressions of faith and alleged miracles, left the community stunned and divided, with some drawn to Peck's fervor and others, like Hannington, deeply skeptical of his motives. Peck's ultimate goal was not spiritual guidance or money, but narcissistic control over Amos Babcock and the community's allegiance. exploiting Babcock's vulnerability for his own egotistical needs. This manipulation was starkly evident in the theatrical and chaotic revival meeting, which, despite its religious veneer, was aimed more at cementing Peck's influence than genuine spiritual awakening. Peck's dramatic declarations and resultant trances and prophecies of two women, Sarah Babcock and Sarah Cornwall, stirred fervent belief in imminent apocalyptic events among the locals. Despite skepticism from figures like Mr. Hannington, who viewed the hysteria as delusion, the community was eager to document these prophecies, leading to a night visit by Hannington to record the women's messages, which included a call for his conversion, of course. The revival fervor escalated, leading to continuous services and heightening the community's spiritual hysteria. Amos Babcock, mainly influenced by Peck's teachings, descended into madness. Displaying bizarre behavior and neglecting his responsibilities, including the care of cattle entrusted to him by Hannington. This neglect prompted Hannington's intervention, during which Hannington threatened to reclaim the cattle due to neglect. That night, Amos's erratic actions culminated in a declaration of the world's end, further indicating his loss of sanity. Amos frightened his family as, wide-eyed, he peered out the window, saying that some unknown group of people would be there soon. He closed the window shutters, and the violence began, first terrifying his wife and children, ranting and raving, spitting, and even tossing his 3-year-old Sarah across the room into a wall. His eldest sister, Mercy, was his ultimate target. An article by J.W. Lawrence in New Brunswick Magazine, Volume 1, 1898, recounted what happened in the Babcock home that night. Quote, Amos Babcock, his eyes flashing with the frenzy of insanity, arranged his family in order on a long bench against the wall, the eldest girl being at one end near the fire, and his wife and youngest child at the other end. He then took a clasp knife and began to sharpen it on a whetstone. Going over to his sister Mercy, he commanded her to remove her dress, go on her knees and prepare for death, for her hour was come. She obeyed without hesitation. He next ordered his brother Jonathan to take off his clothes, and the infatuated man did so. Nothing appeared surprising to that strange household of deluded beings. Amos now acted as one possessed of a devil. He went to the window several times and looked out as though expecting something to happen. Then he laid his knife down on the floor on top of the whetstone, the two making the shape of a cross. Stamping on the whetstone, he broke it, calling out that it was the cross of Christ. He picked up the knife, went to where his sister was still kneeling, and stabbed her with savage strength. She fell to the floor, blood gushing from the wound, and died in a few moments. This fearful act seems to have brought the family to their senses. As soon as Jonathan saw the blood flow, he rushed to the door and fled, naked as he was, in the darkness of that winter night, to the house of Joseph Poirier, a quarter of a mile distant. There he was supplied with clothing and went to Mr. Hannington's house, where he aroused the inmates by crying and shouting that his brother Amos had stabbed his sister. End quote. Amos had not merely stabbed Mercy, he disemboweled her. The small village had no magistrate at the time. It was up to William Hannington to arrest Amos Babcock, but he didn't want to. Begrudgingly, he strapped on his snowshoes and set off. He aimed for Joseph Poirier Sr.'s place, but ended up at young Joseph Poirier's house by accident, since there were no public roads in the area at the time. It was snowy and it was hard to get around. Hannington was looking for a couple of the Poirier men to help him with the arrest. When he finally found them at the elder Poirier's home, they agreed to help. By then it was around 2 a.m. When they entered the crime scene, they saw Amos Babcock still there pacing with his bloody hands clasped together. Hannington told the Poiriers to grab him. Babcock resisted, asking what they were doing, to which they replied they were arresting him. Then Babcock yelled, "Gideon's men, arise!" prompting Amos's sons Caleb and Henry to try and help him. They were quickly subdued and Babcock was detained. Mercy Hall's body wasn't in the house, and its location was unknown. When they asked Mrs. Babcock if her sister-in-law was dead, she confirmed. Later, at dawn, some neighbors arrived and found the body in a snowdrift hidden apparently by Babcock, who seemed to be trying to cover his tracks by sweeping snow as he walked back to the house.
So apparently and seemed to. So, you know, if
right,
if it was him, if it was him, that doesn't work with the idea of insanity, from what I understand, right? Because if he was truly insane, he just would have done it and not tried to hide it.
Right. So there are some people today, some scholars actually, who will say they feel like this man would not be tried today and found guilty. But this behavior after the crime indicates some feeling of guilt to me.
Right.
Vince Lee, who did the Greyhound bus thing.
Yeah.
He was insane at the time that that happened.
Yeah.
And he was found not criminally responsible.
It wasn't him. It was his insanity.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah. Yeah. However, this guy, there was a shade of it. There was definitely shades of a misguided belief in things, and perhaps a bit of a psychotic break. But does somebody who is fully in full flight from reality hide a body in a snowdrift and then try to cover things up? I don't know.
And often in cases the Crown will point out, is that the right word? The Crown will point out that he wasn't insane because he knew better and tried to hide the body.
Exactly. Now securely tied up, Babcock was taken to Mr. Hannington's house, where he kept saying, "Aha, aha, aha, it was allowed." They documented Jonathan Babcock's statement and prepared the legal documents for Amos's imprisonment. Upon seeing the papers, Babcock exclaimed, "There are letters to Damascus. Send them to Damascus," showing he was delusional, possibly referencing Saul's persecution of Christians. Afterward, they moved Babcock to Amos Killam's house. There, Babcock's insanity worsened, and they had to tie him down. The weather was too harsh for travel due to primitive road conditions, but as soon as the storm eased, the locals set out to transport Babcock to the county jail in Dorchester, 26 miles away. They secured him with straps, placed him on a sled, and wearing their snowshoes, dragged him through the snow. Many believe that Amos Babcock's murder trial that summer was unfair and that Jacob Peck should have been tried alongside him. Amos Babcock's June 15, 1805 trial in Dorchester, New Brunswick, highlighted significant injustices primarily due to language barriers. Dr. David Bell from the University of New Brunswick pointed out that the court's inability or unwillingness to provide a French translator prevented Amos's French-speaking friends from defending him, suggesting a lack of effort to ensure a fair trial. The meticulous research of David Bell uncovers how Babcock fell under the sway of Jacob Peck. Peck's influence extended deeply into the Babcock household, particularly affecting Amos Babcock's daughter, Dorcas, and exacerbating the family's vulnerability to his radical teachings. Peck was accused of blasphemy and seditious language, but managed to evade conviction, illustrating the legal system's leniency toward him contrasted with its harshness toward Babcock. This disparity highlights the selective enforcement of justice based on social standing and influence.
There's something around inciting violence here, isn't there?
Like, right.
Even though you didn't do it, and I can't think of a big case in Canada, Mike, off the top of my head, where somebody else murdered or did something, but somebody who incited the violence was charged. But it does happen, and I think this is a clear case of inciting that in some ways.
Sure. It was a definite incitement to that violence, you know, like to exorcise the demons before the end times kind of thing was, you know, that would have brought about things faster. So yeah, I think Peck did have some responsibility for it. And the book that I mentioned, the Ballad of Jacob Peck, really goes in depth to that. So if you want to look at that, I would recommend looking at that book, The Ballad of The Ballad of Jacob Peck.
Was he?
By Deborah Comar.
Just a bit of an anarchist or doing this for shits and giggles to see how far he could take it?
I think that might have been part of it, to tell you the truth.
Okay.
Yeah. I think it might have been because he didn't ask really for money. All he wanted was just power over people.
Yeah, and it's just like, let's see how far I can push these people. And he got off on that.
Just narcissistic craziness is what it was.
Yeah.
The details surrounding the trial emphasize its profound unfairness. Babcock, accused of killing his sister under the delusion that she was possessed, was denied legal counsel, a standard practice of the time for capital crimes unless the defendant was proven insane. This lack of representation severely undermined the fairness of the trial. Moreover, the trial's proceedings were marred by language barriers, as potential French-speaking defenders were excluded due to the absence of a translator. This decision further questions the trial's integrity. Witness testimonies against Babcock came from notable community members, including Jonathan Babcock, William Hannington, and Amos Killam. In contrast, the defense's witnesses, Mary Babcock and John Welling, provided a counter-narrative that was ultimately disregarded. The Solicitor General Ward Chipman's opening statement to the jury suggested that Amos's guilt remained unaffected despite his delusions, instigated by Peck, urging the jury toward conviction. Babcock's execution at Dorchester on June 28, 1805, was a swift conclusion to a trial fraught with ethical and legal controversies. His burial beneath the scaffold where he was hanged marks a grim reminder of the era's punitive justice system. Reflecting on the case centuries later, historians and researchers like William Reynolds criticized the trial's proceedings and the overarching judicial practices of the time, advocating for a reevaluation of Babcock's moral responsibility in the light of modern understandings of mental health and legal defense. And Reynolds is one of those who, you know, thinks maybe he wouldn't have been found guilty had he been tried today.
Yeah, and I think it's cases like this that actually cause changed over time in the legal system, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was because we talk about how a lot of people, even at the time, thought it was unfair. And we've seen that in a few other episodes that we've done where people are sort of aghast at how it was handled. And I think over time, social pressure changes the legal system.
Yeah.
It's always an ever-changing thing, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. It's evolving, always evolving.
Always evolving, yeah.
I think that's the sign of a good legal system, one that evolves with the society that it's within. I mean, you know, there was those old Hammurabi laws that were put down many years ago that wouldn't quite work today.
And it's funny, you know, a lot of Americans used to come to the UK and not understand how there isn't a constitution. Right. It's like it's because we change and make it up as we go.
Yeah.
Right? to reflect what's valuable at the time, right?
Here in Canada, we have a Charter of Rights and Freedoms, which is a little different than a constitution. It's also another interesting document.
Charter of Rights, sort of, and freedoms-ish is what I call it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's all. I think we could do a whole podcast on that.
I think a lot of it's been kind of crossed out in terms of reality, right?
Babcock's tragic end highlights the broader themes of justice, influence, and power dynamics within early Canadian society. It presents a cautionary tale about the dangers of unchecked influence, the vulnerability of the marginalized, and the critical importance of fair legal representation. After the turmoil, the Babcock family resettled in Hopewell, New Brunswick, where Dorcas Babcock's relatives were already established. Jonathan Jr. Babcock and some of his children moved back to Nova Scotia. Several Babcocks eventually relocated to Maine. Amos and Dorcas Babcock's daughters married, while their sons Henry and Caleb worked in Dorchester and received a land grant in Upper Sackville, New Brunswick in 1817. Amy and Elizabeth Babcock married the Sears brothers. However, Dorcas Babcock remained unmarried due to the trauma inflicted by Jacob Peck's influence and died around 1842 at 73 in Albert, New Brunswick. So Jacob Peck slithered off relatively unscathed, but red in the face. Jacob was not brought to justice for any role he might have had in the events leading to the tragedy. Instead, after the trial and execution of Amos Babcock, Peck seemingly disappeared from the public eye for a while. However, research by Dr. Bell revealed that Jacob Peck eventually returned to Salisbury, New Brunswick Parish, where he had a family, and not with the lady he was originally going to marry, so again he moved on to another relationship. Despite being ordered to reappear in court for his blasphemous and seditious language during Amos Babcock's trial, there was no real follow-up or any legal action against him. Peck's subsequent activities and the remainder of his life remain primarily undocumented in the historical record, with no further legal repercussions for his actions or his influence on the Babcock family's tragic events.
Two things. First, nobody should be charged with blasphemy.
No, that's a silly thing.
He was supposed to show up and I'm thank my lucky stars.
Sedition is another thing.
I thank my lucky stars I don't live in a country where I can be charged with blasphemy.
Right. Right? There are many that would still do that.
Many do. Mm-hmm. And some countries that we thought never would get there might be moving towards it.
Toward it. I don't know.
Yeah, exactly. And the other, have you seen Guy Ritchie's new show, The Gentleman?
No, I haven't watched it yet.
Okay. There's one gangster who is hyper religious, but he like murders people and everything.
Oh, sure.
And
yeah.
This guy is kind of reminds me of him in a way.
Sure, you take what you want and leave the rest, I guess. The whole murdery part, yeah, well, you know.
It's a very good show. You give
interesting. Yeah. And that's it for Dark Poutine episode 312, Moved by the Spirit, The Murder of Mercy Babcock Hall.
That's right, it's time for voicemails. You can leave us a message at 1-877-327-5786 or 1-877-DARK-PTN. We'd love to hear from you. Let's see who called us this week.
All right, we have a couple of calls this week, and let's get into one of them here.
Hi, Mike and Matthew. It's Lacey from Calgary. It's so fun to hear all of the voicemails from Lacey in PEI, I believe it was. Anyway, I have taken a break, so I haven't heard a lot of episodes. I finally caught up, and I've been calling you a lot in the last little bit, but I don't feel guilty for doing that anymore because I noticed in the last little while you haven't had a lot of phone calls. So I have recovered from some of the ones that hit me a lot harder. You've done so many poignant episodes lately, it's hard to remember all the titles and say all the names and give you guys all the kudos. But I also wanted to give you an You said you were not going to use the words away game for any episodes taking place outside of Canada because game could be taken as rather insensitive, considering you were talking about murder. So I don't know if you were doing that just because you were doing that revisit of one you'd already done an episode on, or if you just kind of forgot. But anyway, I just thought you haven't been getting a lot of calls, and that's something I could call you on. So have a good one. Yeah, and I only said take a shit in your hat one time because I don't think you guys deserve to do that. I think all the poopy people need to do that, but I said it one time when I was really, really upset, so I'm not saying it this time, so take care, and my love to all the fur babies, or if you hate that term, all the fur family. Okay, bye.
So I had to think a little bit about this voicemail before I responded to it, because, yeah, I did say that, but at the same time, why didn't I remember? Because I didn't. I totally forgot. And maybe it was because I just went to calling the episodes where we were out of Canada away instead of away game, instead of something entirely different. So I've come up with a better solution, I think. Let's call them road trips. That way nobody gets hurt.
I love that we have two Lacys that call. It's fantastic. Hey, if anyone else named Lacey, call us as well. Can you imagine if
all the Lacys calling us?
Let's try to get a Lacey in every province.
Oh, gosh. Yeah, that would be funny. We did have another voicemail this week that was really kind of weird.
Okay, play it.
And we get these sometimes. We get these voicemails. I was excited. Oh, look, it's a voicemail. So I listen to the voicemail, and I don't quite understand what it is. So let's listen to this.
如有疑问，英语服务请按一，华语服务请按二，转客服咨询。
Okay, so I guess she's done.
I get those calls all the time,
right?
Like twice a month. So anyone who, I think that's Mandarin, it might be Cantonese, I think it's Mandarin. If anyone speaks Mandarin or Cantonese, whichever one that one is, please can you call us and tell us what she's saying?
Right.
Because we get the call. Like, I think a lot of us get that call all
the time.
She
might be giving us like the secret to the universe or something. And I'm not being coy or weird, but I am actually, but.
My husband thinks it's the Chinese government trying to harass Chinese Canadian citizens.
It might be.
But I'm like, that's for nice, Justin, but it just might be somebody saying, we have a package for you that we can't deliver.
Right. It could be something that simple. Or we have a package that we can't deliver and we want you to pay us.
Yeah, please give us your credit card number now.
Exactly. Maybe it's something like that.
If you speak Mandarin or Cantonese or understand that, please let us know what it says.
Yes, we would appreciate that very much. That's it for this week's voicemails. Again, you can leave us one at 1-877-327-5786 or 1-877-DARK-PTN. We'd love to hear from you, even if it is just to say hi and to tell us to go shit in our hats. If you're stumped for what to chat with us about, a quick story is welcome. Well, there you have it. We don't have any patrons or donors this week. Donut Money Donuts?
So we have Donut in the Donut Money account today.
Yeah, well, and I'm kind of watching my figure right now, so it's probably a good thing that I'm not getting any donut.
Me too.
Money. But we could have too. Some carrot money and celery money. Yeah, you know, I got to get me some of those Mexico blueberries. Cheap.
I'm down 12 pounds.
Mike. Wow. That's great.
It's a start. It's a start.
It is a start. Well, it's a great start, actually. You know, did you cut one of your feet off or?
No, what I realized. It goes back to that old movie, Analyze This, where Billy Crystal is a therapist and yes. He gets mob guys. Side note, Billy Crystal named after Billie Holiday, who used to babysit him. She was a friend of the family.
Oh, that's fun.
That's so cool. And the one mafia guy is like, I'm trying to lose my weight. You know, when they're going, hey, I'm going to the deli. He's like, I'm trying to lose some weight. Do they have something that's lighter? And the other mob guy goes, yeah, it's called half a fucking sandwich. and so all I've done is just chopped what I eat in half.
Oh, there you go. That's probably a good thing. I think eating less is kind of a key.
I mean, it's funny because it's not complicated. Mm-hmm. I eat healthy food. I eat too much of it. And so what I've got to the point where I put stuff on a plate and like I'm serving it. And then I look and I'm like, is that too much? And then I scoop some out and put it back into the pot.
There you go. Yeah, I'm doing another program. I've done Noom and I've done all those other things, but now I'm trying Weight Watchers. So
okay,
yeah, I've done it before. It's really different now than when I did it before, and whatever, you know. I think just paying attention to what I'm putting inside of me, and challenging myself to get up and move around a little bit is going to make a difference.
Isn't there also a group called like Overeaters Anonymous?
There is. Or yeah.
Like
yep.
Okay.
Yep.
Whatever works for you, right?
Whatever works.
As long as you do it in a healthy way, whatever works for you.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, I have been known to take things to the extreme, even healthy things. But
no, not
yes,
you.
Yes, me.
Mike going overboard?
Well,
no.
If one slug of NyQuil will help me, this is before I sobered up. If one slug will help me, the whole bottle will do me good.
Oh gosh.
Yeah, it's they're just shooters for alcoholics, is what. Sunday shooters for alcoholics. When the liquor store is closed, hey, there's always scope and cough syrup.
Other cough and cold syrups available.
Sure. Anyway, thanks to all our patrons and Donut Money donors, past and present, for your generosity. It helps to keep the show going. You can become a patron of Dark Poutine at patreon.com/darkpoutine. For a one-time donation, you can send us donut money via PayPal using our email address, darkpoutinepodcast@gmail.com. If you don't already subscribe to the show, it would mean a lot if you did. You can easily find Dark Poutine on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows. If you haven't gotten yours yet, my book, Murder, Madness, and Mayhem, is available to order via a link on the Dark Poutine website. And speaking of darkpoutine.com, please check it out for show notes and other cool stuff. We'd appreciate it if you took the time to give Dark Poutine a like or a follow on Facebook and Instagram. Most importantly, thank you for listening, and tell your friends about us. Word of mouth is a powerful thing. And that's it for this episode of Dark Poutine. So until next time, don't forget to be a good egg and not a bad apple.
And go poop in your toques.
Do that.
I said to my parents, don't trust her. I wouldn't listen.
Every family has a secret.
Joy Delaney, mother of four, has gone missing.
From the author of Big Little Lies comes a chilling new mystery to W.
You are an emotional chaos sinkhole, Amy, and I'm sick of it!
Starring Annette Bening.
Nobody can break your heart like your own children.
And Sam Neill.
She will come back.
Here we go. Strap in.
Apples never fall. All new Thursdays, only on W. Stream on Stack TV.